Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, a brief pause to economically evaluate. There will be an automotive interlude, and then a clarinet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 31st of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It is good, I think, every now and then, to pause and take stock, to see where things are and where they might be going. That's been our theme this week, with lots of corporate profits, most of them pretty good, and the Fed yesterday cutting interest rates, while at the same time, Chair Jay Powell said the economy writ large is pretty good. And that, in a big roundabout kind of way, gets us to tomorrow, and a little thing I'll call the October jobs report. Probably not going to be pretty, mostly because of the GM strike. But even if job growth does keep slowing, and that has been the trend on the first Friday of every month, this is still one of the best overall job markets in decades, which means, especially in some middle-wage industries where demand for workers is really high, that means that higher wages have finally begun to stick. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off.
Just before 7 this morning, about 100 electrician apprentices filed into classrooms with their notebooks and steaming coffee mugs at Local 48 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, today we're going to, after the test, we're going to change it up and we're going to look at parallel circuits.
31-year-old Amy Haddix takes classes one day a week and works on construction sites the rest of the time.
When we journey out, when we complete our 5 years of training and schooling, we make $45 an hour. It's pretty great. And then plus benefits, before this I was making, I have a master's degree and was making $24 an hour.
The union's been doing well for its members, with the base wage up more than 5% since last year, says training coordinator Bridget Quinn.
Yeah, anybody pretty much right now who wants to work is working. We have unfilled calls at our dispatch office.
Quinn says the industry recovered slowly after the Great Recession, but it's kicked into high gear in the last few years.
We've seen a huge surge in the number of apprentices that we have taken in. Lots of overtime if you choose to take it. There's a lot of hiring incentives.
Wages for construction workers, machine operators, and warehouse associates are up between 3.5% and 6% year over year. And there have also been outsized wage gains for security guards, retail managers, certified nursing assistants, all of which pay in the $30,000 to $35,000 range, says economist Daniel Zhao at jobsite Glassdoor.
And that is a really good sign that the benefits of the tight labor market are reaching even lower income workers.
In construction, that tight labor market is leading to changes on the job. 56-year-old electrician Tony Liebert in Madison, Wisconsin, says there's been lots of new spending on school building and other public works, and contractors are chronically understaffed.
So they just push their guys a little bit harder for finishing jobs or using pre-made assemblages made by non-union people.
And he doesn't see much new blood coming into the trade.
Getting young people into the labor market has been extremely hard. Because the tech industry, if you can get $15 an hour coding and you can get $10 an hour as an apprentice electrician, you're taking the 15 coding.
He says stick around and become a journeyman like he has, and you can make more than 40 an hour, benefits included, at least until the next construction downturn rolls around. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wage data is going to be a big part of the jobs report that we will get tomorrow, so we'll also get a pretty good update on Mitchell's story. 8:30 Washington time is when the jobs report drops. Elsewhere in capitalism today, traders seemed a little bit disheartened, actually. Jay Powell's rate cut yesterday notwithstanding. There were some trade war rumblings. Maybe that was it? Don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Ford Motor Company has come to a tentative agreement with the United Auto Workers on a new labor contract after just 3 days of talks. It took GM and the UAW, you might remember, a 40-day strike and more than $1 billion in corporate losses, hundreds of millions for the workers, to come to a similar deal. And that's kind of by design. The UAW typically targets one company for the tough first set of negotiations, then gets the others to go along. It's a watered-down version of something called sectoral bargaining, where labor unions negotiate for all workers and an entire industry rather than just company by company. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino explains.
There was a time when sector-wide bargaining was common in industries like steel, construction, and mining, but the idea fell out of favor, in part because the labor movement was divided. So when federal laws that protect unions were put in place in the late 30s and early 40s, sectoral bargaining wasn't part of the deal. Instead, unions could only bargain with one company at a time, called enterprise bargaining. And today,
the problem is that system is really mismatched with the way our economy is organized.
Kate Andreas is a law professor at the University of Michigan. She says union membership has dropped dramatically in recent decades, but she notes that wages are higher in countries like France and Germany, where sectoral bargaining is common.
So that helps ensure that companies still get to compete on lots of factors like innovation and management, but not by engaging in a race to the bottom on wages and benefits.
Five of the top Democratic presidential candidates have included the idea in their platforms. Harley Shaken, a labor expert at UC Berkeley, says the idea is now being taken more seriously because of growing income inequality and the gigification of work.
Enterprise bargaining was never set up for that diversity of employer-worker relationships.
But sectoral bargaining is not permitted under current labor law, so it would require new legislation, and the chances of that passing are low with the Senate controlled by Republicans. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One of the reasons GM's negotiations were so tough is because carmakers are trying to figure out an uncertain, but almost certainly very expensive, future. A future that's going to have electric cars and self-driving cars and who knows what else that these companies have to be spending money on now. One way they can spread the economic risk of that around is to pool their resources, which is what explains the news of Fiat Chrysler, which has announced plans to merge with the French firm PSA Group. It's the parent company of Peugeot. And as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, the deal could give both companies something they need.
Electric vehicles, ride-sharing, mobility as a service. These all sound like Silicon Valley buzzwords. But Rebecca Lindland, longtime automotive analyst, says car companies are taking them seriously and actively teaming up to invest in them.
You'll see GM and Honda have agreements. BMW and Mercedes are working on things. You know, sort of unlikely bedfellows.
Fiat Chrysler, or FCA, is doing pretty well, selling its Jeeps and Dodge pickups in the US. PSA sells funky European hatchbacks under the brands Peugeot, Citroën, Opel, and Vauxhall.
Will it run on petrol?
Yes, but it will also be electric with an engine that sounds just like this.
I don't hear anything.
Exactly.
That's a European commercial for Peugeot's new 208 city car. Jeffrey Hanna from SBD Automotive says combining forces could let the new company develop more electric vehicles faster and keep up with the competition.
It just allows them to take on the major players in the market with just much more scale and much more cash on hand.
A merged auto company could be the world's fourth largest and force better deals with suppliers of things like batteries because of its scale. This is not a done deal, though, says Jessica Caldwell at Edmunds.
On day one, it's always a merger of equals, and we're going to do this, that, and the other, and it seems always straightforward. Usually down the road, there's certainly some hiccups.
We did see that earlier this year when Fiat Chrysler tried to merge with Renault, but ran into issues with the French government's requirements for job and oversight guarantees. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
We've been running a series the past couple of months called Adventures in Housing, Tales of How and Why We Live Where We Live. Sometimes, though, the adventure is more like a long, drawn-out saga. That's the case for one woman in Houston whose experiences with the housing have shaped her career. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story.
Chriselle Pellet is standing outside her house, waiting for her kids to get home from school.
A few neighbors play dominoes on the front porch next door. Someone else mows a lawn.
It's actually a pretty quiet neighborhood aside from the railroad track down here and the roosters in my backyard.
Rochelle never expected to be living here in Cashmere Gardens, a historically black neighborhood that's still struggling with the legacy of segregation and neglect. Then her great-aunt Joyce died and left the house to the family.
Before she passed, she used to always tell us, no one's going to want to live in this neighborhood. Look at the dumping. Sometimes the trash isn't picked up on time. Who wants to live out here?
Rochelle did. And to understand why, you got to understand her history. Back in 2008, she was working as an architect. Her future husband, Lycée Palais, was in new home sales. And they were all set to buy their own house. Then the financial crisis hit.
I lost my job. That was in May. And then his company folded in July. And we got married in August. Both of us unemployed.
Eventually, Chriselle got a job as a housing advocate for low-income Texans. Lycée got his real estate license, and they decided to rent a house.
And application after application, we were denied. Our credit was fine. We just thought, well, maybe it's a really, really hot market.
But then the couple across the hall in their apartment building asked Lycée to help them find a house to rent.
It happened to be a white couple. The very first house they put an application in for, they got the house. In 2015, with two educated folks that happen to be black, this is still what we're dealing with.
Fast forward to August 2017.
It has been a long day in Southeast Texas. Harvey, dumping so much rain.
In Houston, up to 19 inches of rain has fallen.
Thousands had to be rescued.
Most of the homes in Cashmere Gardens flooded, including her aunt's. A few months later, Aunt Joyce, who'd been sick, died. And the family had to decide what to do. After all she'd been through, Chriselle realized Aunt Joyce's warnings.
Look at the dumping. Who wants to live out here?
Were actually a reason to stay.
Working in the housing advocacy space, I see historically black neighborhoods just crumbling. And the little bit of wealth that communities of color have just whittling away. And so it was important to me and to our family that we were able to hold on to that.
The family moved in about a year ago and set about making the quirky house their own. Aunt Joyce was a caterer, so there were two kitchens, but only one full bathroom. And her taste would have pleased Liberace. They ditched the mermaid coffee table, but held on to the opulent chandelier and tufted red velvet bench.
This was a home where there was always entertaining. We'll be doing things for all the upcoming holidays, just like Aunt Joyce would. So to continue that legacy is so important to us. And it's definitely one of the best decisions that our family has made.
Chriselle's put her advocacy skills to work, calling to complain when the trash isn't picked up or a new pile of junk shows up in a drainage ditch. But she's also fighting a bigger fight. She's now director of the Home Coalition, working to make sure communities like hers aren't left behind as Houston recovers from Harvey. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
If you've got an adventure in housing you'd like to share, we're here for you. Tell us at marketplace.org. Coming up.
He says to me, well, you know, you rejected me. And I'm like, what? You rejected me?
A misunderstanding that wasn't actually a misunderstanding. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 140 points today, about a half percent, 27,046. NASDAQ lost 11 points, a tenth percent, 8,292. The S&P 500 shed 9 points, 0.3%. 3,037. That big merger proposal we were talking about earlier, mixed bag for the two companies. Fiat Chrysler gained 8.2%. Peugeot's parent company PSA or Group PSA, en français, fell 12.8%. I don't know why. World Wrestling Entertainment got smacked down after missing revenue projections and trimmed its outlook for the rest of the year. WWE lost more than 15%. In other news, World Wrestling Entertainment is a publicly traded company. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.68%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. These are more casual times, shall we say. Overall, yes, but professionally too. For good or ill, what we wear to the office just usually isn't that dressy. And as a result, the power suit just isn't all that powerful anymore. That's the gist of Mark Dent's piece the other day in Vox. Mark, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You say in this piece, well, you say a lot of things. There's some good history and some context, but you say at one point that suits are the sign or the uniform of the powerless now. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that means while we have obviously seen a decline in the number of men who are wearing suits over the last couple of decades, we're seeing that decline usually in finance, people who are working in tech. The people who tend to wear suits now are people who are interviewing for jobs. They're people who are maybe running security at these fancy buildings in New York or San Francisco, where everyone else who's going there to work is wearing slacks and a button down.
Your perhaps counterintuitive example of this is Mark Zuckerberg going to Congress a year, whatever it was ago, on his apology tour.
Exactly. Zuckerberg was there in April 2018 when he was just getting asked about Facebook's basically inability to police Russian spies. Right. And he obviously usually is wearing a sweatshirt, a hooded sweatshirt, a very expensive one. But when he had to come in and talk to Congress, when he was in trouble, he was playing by their rules and dressing up.
One of the things you point out is that this decline in the suit, as it were, has benefited women in some workplaces to some degree.
Yeah, exactly. Back in like the 60s and the 70s, when women were finally starting to get into the workplace, and especially at these higher executive levels, everybody had this uniform, basically. And women, at least through a fashion standpoint, they didn't look like the rest of the leadership, which some people believe that kind of kept them out of those roles. And so now that fashion standards have loosened a little bit, it's a little bit easier for them to get into those roles now.
Where does this go? Because one of the things you say is that the generation being born today will never know, probably, workplaces where suits are the thing, right? So are they ever coming back? Are we all just going to wear like shorts and flip-flops to work at some point?
Yeah, there's a couple of different sort of opinions on that. Some people who, really are studying the industry think that there could be a maybe slight resurgence because of the fact that we might be having a recession. During those times, people tend to just sort of button up a little bit more. So there's a possibility that that could happen. But even when I was growing up, and I'm 32 years old, yeah. When I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, I saw my dad wearing a suit every day. And people who were born before me, they saw their parents wearing suits every day, and they aspired to that. And there's nothing to aspire to anymore. You wear a suit. Maybe you have to do it for a wedding or a funeral, and that's it.
It's all about expectations, though, right? Because look, I mean, I'm wearing, what am I wearing? Khakis and a polo shirt today, which is pretty much my standard uniform. But mm-hmm. Wearing a suit feels good. You dress up, you feel good, you look good, you feel powerful, right?
Well, it does feel good, but I think that last part, how long are we going to feel good and powerful if nobody is wearing yeah. these? If we start identifying them with like, oh, wow, I have to wear this suit because I'm going for this job interview yeah. or I'm going to court because I'm in trouble or because I'm Mark Zuckerberg and I'm in big trouble, then is it really going to feel that good?
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody dresses up for work around here and the first thing I say to them is, hey, you got a job interview?
Yeah, it's so true. And I talked to a fairly young lawyer in Dallas about that same thing who's at one of these sort of prestigious, very good law firms, and they don't wear suits on a regular day. And that's exactly what one of the partners asked him when he went into the office wearing a suit. And yeah, he had to tell her no.
Mark Dent, writing in Vox about the demise of what used to be called the power suit. Mark, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Kai.
This is a story about a dream deferred, or really, it's about a dream denied. If you want to land a job at a top-tier orchestra, you usually have to wait until somebody dies or retires before a spot opens up. It's that tough a job market. And when there is an opening, a single position can easily draw hundreds of musicians. The principal viola of the Cincinnati Symphony once told a reporter that statistically, it's probably easier to get into the NBA than to get a spot in that orchestra. Rima Kreis, the host of our new podcast, it's called This Is Uncomfortable, has this story of a musician and his orchestral dream and its unexpected price tag.
Eric Abramovitz pretty much knew when he was a kid that he wanted to be a professional clarinetist. Growing up, he performed in local orchestras and won a bunch of awards. Then in college, he decided to audition for this elite music conservatory, which would fast-track his career. He'd get a full ride and study under a world-renowned clarinet instructor. Leading up to the audition, he practiced for hours a day.
It was so much in my head that I was having dreams about it and having dreams of, you know, going to the audition and not knowing what to play and, all, you know, all these terrible dreams, but also a few good dreams that I got in and stuff like that.
Yeah, he did not end up getting in.
That was basically crushing to me.
Then 2 years later, while he was trying out for a second time, he had the strangest interaction with the instructor.
So when I get in there, right away I'm met with not the happiest expression on his face.
The mood feels tense.
And he says to me, "So why are you here?"
This is where things get weird.
And I said, "Well, you know, I want to go here. I want to study with you." And he says to me, "Well, you know, you rejected me." And I'm like, "Well, what? You rejected me?"
Huh?
And he's like, "No, you rejected me." And I insisted, "No, please, you rejected me. I would remember."
Eric later found out that he, in fact, had been accepted the first time. And the rejection email he got was completely fake.
The first thing that's going through my head is actually joy, because I'm thinking, oh, my God, I did get in. And then I started thinking, okay, I have to find out who did it.
He thought maybe another clarinetist had sabotaged him, someone vying for the same spot. His friends, though, had another theory.
People started saying, well, you know, you were living with this girlfriend, and, you know, I would cut them off. I'd be like, that's insane. No, like, that would never happen.
But that is exactly what happened. After digging around, Eric found out that his ex-girlfriend had deleted his acceptance letter and sent a fake rejection from a fake email address.
God knows what reason, whether it was, you know, to keep me around with her, or if it was jealousy, or if it was just some kind of thrill that she gets out of doing crazy stuff like that.
I reached out to his former girlfriend for an interview, but she didn't respond. Eric says he never tried to contact her. Instead, he sued.
This was bigger than just a little fight between a boyfriend and girlfriend. This was, you know, this was something that is definitely illegal.
He didn't necessarily want her arrested. He wanted compensation. So Eric hired a lawyer. He claimed damages for deceit, invasion of his privacy, and infliction of mental suffering. His lawyer, Marshall Reinhart, says he had to prove Eric not only suffered an emotional cost, but a financial one. The question then becomes, how do you put a price tag on lost opportunity?
You want to persuade the court that this individual would have continued on that arc and would ultimately have been extremely successful.
Marshall calculated the scholarship's worth, what Eric spent on additional education, and how much he lost in potential income since his career was delayed. He presented that number to the court, and the judge was convinced. His ex-girlfriend had to pay Eric $284,000. But there's just one problem. Jen does not have that money. Marshall says she claims to be a student, living week to week.
If she had a job, we would be entitled to garnish 20% of her earnings.
So until then, it's a waiting game. Meanwhile, Eric, he eventually landed a job at the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, somewhere he wanted to be, even if it's delayed. But thinking back to it all, it still stings.
When it comes to missed opportunities or lost time, nothing can really give you back what you lost. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, money, it helps. It's the closest thing to easing the wound a little bit.
It's normal to think of moments in our lives and wonder what could have been. Just in Eric's case, he's able to put an actual price tag on that lost opportunity, $280,000. I'm Rima Khres for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in honor of the day. We did zombies yesterday, actually, so technically we're covered, even though I haven't seen the pilot of Walking Dead, but that's a whole different thing. Forbes magazine does its own thing around this time every year that caught our eye. Top earning dead celebrities of 2019. Number one, going away. Come on, you know this, right? Michael Jackson. Then Elvis Presley, the obvious number two. Charles Schulz, he wrote Peanuts, kind of a surprise. Arnold Palmer is number four. Bob Marley rounds out the top five. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 140 today, 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 11, about 0.1%. The S&P 500 gave back 9 points, 0.3%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, and Heron Bikella are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the Marketplace managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.